Chapter 12. Susie ran to her room for a light cloak, and without changing her high-heeled satin slippers went out with the four men. There was no moon, thank heaven there was no moon, but the stars hung over them as close as fruit, and secret fragrances dropped on them from garden walls. Susie's heart tightened with memories of Como. They wandered on, laughing and dawdling, and yielding to the drifting whims of aimless people. Presently someone proposed taking a nearer look at the facade of San Giorgio Maggiore, and they hailed a gondola, and were rowed out through the bobbing lanterns and twanging guitar strings. When they landed again, Gillo, always acutely bored by scenery, and particularly resentful of midnight aesthetics, suggested a nightclub near at hand, which was said to be jolly. The prince warmly supported this proposal, but on Susie's curt refusal they started their rambling again, circuitously threading the vague dark lanes and making for the Piazza and Florian's Ices. Suddenly, at a calle corner, unfamiliar and yet somehow known to her, Susie paused to stare about her with a laugh. But the Ices, surely that's their palace? And the windows all lit up. They must be giving a party. Oh, do let's go up and surprise them. The idea struck her as one of the drollest that S.E. had ever originated, and she wondered that her companions should respond so languidly. I can't see anything very thrilling in surprising the Hickses, Gillo protested, defrauded of possible excitements, and Strefford added. Tea would surprise me more than them if I went. But Susie insisted feverishly. Who don't know? It may be awfully exciting. I have an idea that Coral's announcing her engagement to Nick. Come, give me a hand, Streff and you the other. Frenchie began to hum the first bars of Donna Anna's entrance in Don Giovanni. I haven't got a black cloak and a mask. ... Oh, your face will do, said Strefford, laying his hand on her arm. She drew back, flushing crimson. Breckenridge and the prince had sprung on ahead, and Gillo, lumbering after them, was already halfway up the stairs. My face? My face? What's the matter with my face? Do you know any reason why I shouldn't go to the Hickses tonight? Susie broke out in sudden wrath. None whatever, except that if you do it will bore me to death, Strefford returned, with serenity. Oh, in that case, no, come on. I hear those fools banging on the door already. He caught her by the hand, and they started up the stairway. But on the first landing she paused, twisted her hand out of his, and without a word, without a conscious thought, dashed down the long flight, across the great resounding vestibule, and out into the darkness of the calle. Strefford caught up with her, and they stood a moment silent in the night. Susie, what the devil's the matter? The matter? Can't you see? That I'm tired, that I've got a splitting headache, that you bore me to death, one and all of you. She turned and laid a deprecating hand on his arm. Streffy, old dear, don't mind me. But for God's sake find a gondola and send me home. Alone? Alone. It was never any concern of Streff's if people wanted to do things he did not understand, and she knew that she could count on his obedience. They walked on in silence to the next canal, and he picked up a passing gondola and put her in it. Now go and amuse yourself, she called after him, as the boat shot under the nearest bridge. Anything, anything, to be alone, away from the folly and futility that would be all S.E. had left if Nick were to drop out of her life. But perhaps he has already dropped for good, she thought as she set her foot on the Vanderlyn threshold. The short summer night was already growing transparent. A newborn breeze stirred the soiled surface of the water and sent it lapping freshly against the old palace doorways. Nearly 2 o'clock. Nick had no doubt come back long ago. Susie hurried up the stairs, reassured by the mere thought of his nearness. She knew that when their eyes and their lips met it would be impossible for anything to keep them apart. The gondolier dozing on the landing roused himself to receive her and to proffer two envelopes. The upper one was a telegram for Stretford. She threw it down again, and paused under the lantern hanging from the painted vault, the other envelope in her hand. The address it bore was in Nick's writing. And did the signer leave this for me? Has he gone out again? Gone out again? But the signer had not come in since dinner. Of that the gondolier was positive, as he had been on duty all the evening. A boy had brought the letter, an unknown boy. He had left it without waiting. It must have been about half an hour after the signora had herself gone out with her guests. Susie, hardly hearing him, fled onto her own room, and there, beside the very lamp which, 2 months before, had illuminated Ellie Vanderlyn's fatal letter, she opened Nick's. Don't think me hard on you, dear, but I've got to work this thing out by myself. The sooner the better, don't you agree? So I'm taking the express to Milan presently. You'll get a proper letter in a day or two. I wish I could think, now, of something to say that would show you I'm not a brute, but I can't. N.L. There was not much of the night left in which to sleep, even had a semblance of sleep been achievable. The letter fell from Susie's hands, and she crept out onto the balcony and cowered there, her forehead pressed against the balustrade, the dawn wind stirring in her thin laces. Through her closed eyelids and the tightly clenched fingers pressed against them, she felt the penetration of the growing light, the relentless advance of another day, a day without purpose, and without meaning, a day without Nick. At length she dropped her hands, and staring from dry lids, saw a rim of fire above the roofs across the Grand Canal. She sprang up, ran back into her room, and dragging the heavy curtains shut across the windows, stumbled over in the darkness to the lounge, and fell among its pillows face downward, groping, delving for a deeper night. Dot, she started up, stiff and aching, to see a golden wedge of sun on the floor at her feet. As he had slept, then was it possible? It must be 8 or 9 o'clock already. As he had slept like a drunkard with that letter on the table at her elbow. Ah, now she remembered, as he had dreamed, that the letter was a dream. But there, inexorably, it lay, and she picked it up, and slowly, painfully reread it. Then she tore it in 2 shreds, hunted for a match, and kneeling before the empty hearth, as though she were accomplishing some funeral rite, she burned every shred of it to ashes. Nick would thank her for that someday. After a bath and a hurried toilet, she began to be aware of feeling younger and more hopeful. After all, Nick had merely said that he was going away for a day or two. And the letter was not cruel. There were tender things in it, showing through the curt words. She smiled at herself a little stiffly in the glass, put a dash of red on her colorless lips, and rang for the maid. Coffee, Guyavana, please. And will you tell Mr. Stretford that I should like to see him presently? If Nick really kept to his intention of staying away for a few days, she must trump up some explanation of his absence. But her mind refused to work, and the only thing she could think of was to take Stretford into her confidence. She knew that he could be trusted in a real difficulty. His impish malice transformed itself into a resourceful ingenuity when his friends required it. The maid stood looking at her with a puzzled gaze, and Susie somewhat sharply repeated her order. Don't wake him on purpose, she added, foreseeing the probable effect on Stretford's temper. But, signora, the gentleman is already out. Already out? Stretford, who could hardly be routed from his bed before luncheon time. Is it so late? Susie cried, incredulous. After 9. And the gentleman took the 8 o'clock train for England. Gervaso said he had received a telegram. He left word that he would write to the signora. The door closed upon the maid, and Susie continued to gaze at her painted image in the glass, as he had been trying to outstare an importunate stranger. There was no one left for her to take counsel of, then no one, but poor Fred Gillow. She made a grimace at the idea. But what on earth could have summoned Stretford back to England? Zia, Nick Lansing, in the Milan Express, was roused by the same bar of sunshine lying across his knees. He yawned, looked with disgust at his stolidly sleeping neighbors, and wondered why he had decided to go to Milan, and what on earth he should do when he got there. The difficulty about trenchant decisions was that the next morning they generally left one facing a void. When the train drew into the station at Milan, he scrambled out, got some coffee, and having drunk it decided to continue his journey to Genoa. The state of being carried passively onward postponed action and dulled thought, and after 12 hours of furious mental activity, that was exactly what he wanted. He fell into a doze again, waking now and then, to haggard intervals of more thinking, and then dropping off to the clank and rattle of the train. Inside his head, in his waking intervals, the same clanking and grinding of wheels and chains went on unremittingly. He had done all his lucid thinking within an hour of leaving the Palazzo Vanderlyn the night before. Since then, his brain had simply continued to revolve indefatigably about the same old problem. His cup of coffee, instead of clearing his thoughts, had merely accelerated their pace. At Genoa he wandered about in the hot streets, bought a cheap suitcase and some underclothes, and then went down to the port in search of a little hotel he remembered there. An hour later he was sitting in the coffee room, smoking and glancing vacantly over the papers, while he waited for dinner, when he became aware of being timidly but intently examined by a small round-faced gentleman with eyeglasses who sat alone at the adjoining table. "Hello, Buddles!" Lansing exclaimed, recognizing with surprise the recalcitrant secretary who had resisted Miss Hicks' endeavor to convert him to tie a polo. Mr. Buddles, blushing to the roots of his scant hair, half rose and bowed ceremoniously. Nick Lansing's first feeling was of annoyance at being disturbed in his solitary broodings. His next, of relief at having to postpone them, even to converse with Mr. Buddles. "No idea you were here. Is the yacht in harbor?" he asked, remembering that the Ibis must be just about to spread her wings. Mr. Buddles, at salute behind his chair, signed a mute negation. For the moment he seemed too embarrassed to speak. "You're here as an advance guard? I remember now I saw Miss Hicks in Venice the day before yesterday," Lansing continued, dazed at the thought that hardly 48 hours had passed since his encounter with Coral in the Scalzi. Mr. Buddles, instead of speaking, had tentatively approached his table. "May I take this seat for a moment, Mr. Lansing? Thank you. No, I am not here as an advance guard, though I believe the Ibis is due sometime tomorrow." He cleared his throat, wiped his eyeglasses on a silk handkerchief, replaced them on his nose, and went on solemnly. "Perhaps, to clear up any possible misunderstanding, I ought to say that I am no longer in the employ of Mr. Hicks." Lansing glanced at him sympathetically. It was clear that he suffered horribly in imparting this information, though his compact face did not lend itself to any dramatic display of emotion. "Really," Nick smiled, and then ventured. "Hope it's not owing to conscientious objections to tie a polo?" Mr. Buddle's blush became a smoldering agony. "Miss Hicks mentioned to you. Told you? No, Mr. Lansing. I am principled against the effete art of tie a polo, and of all his contemporaries, I confess. But if Miss Hicks chooses to surrender herself momentarily to the unwholesome spell of the Italian decadence, it is not for me to protest or to criticize. Her intellectual and aesthetic range so far exceeds my humble capacity that it would be ridiculous, unbecoming. He broke off, and once more wiped a faint moisture from his eyeglasses. It was evident that he was suffering from a distress which he longed, and yet dreaded to communicate. But Nick made no farther effort to bridge the gulf of his own preoccupations, and Mr. Buddles, after an expectant pause, went on. "If you see me here today, it is only because, after a somewhat abrupt departure, I find myself unable to take leave of our friends without a last look at the Ibis, the scene of so many stimulating hours. But I must beg you, he added earnestly, should you see Miss Hicks or any other member of the party to make no allusion to my presence in Genoa. I wish, said Mr. Buggles with simplicity, to preserve the strictest incognito. Lansing glanced at him kindly. H, but isn't that a little unfriendly? No other course is possible, Mr. Lansing, said the ex-secretary, and I commit myself to your discretion. The truth is, if I am here it is not to look once more at the Ibis, but at Miss Hicks. Once only. You will understand me, and appreciate what I am suffering. He bowed again, and trotted away on his small, tightly booted feet, pausing on the threshold to say, Rom the first it was. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.